It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, after years of debate, regulators are giving the go-ahead on a new power line running from La Crosse to Madison.
But first, it's time for our Wisconsin News Roundup. This week, UW System President Ray Cross said he'd quit if state legislators don't scale back funding cuts. Also, UW-Superior started offering buyouts for certain staff members in order to save money.
And in Milwaukee, a panel upheld the firing of former police officer Christopher Manny for his shooting of Dontre Hamilton last April.
WPR's assistant news director Noah Ovshinsky is back. He joins us every week at this time for a look at the big stories out of Wisconsin. Noah, welcome back.
It's good to be here, and as almost always, happy Friday.
Happy Friday back at you, Noah. So we're going to start with some news related to the UW, the proposed UW system budget cuts. What have we heard from System President Ray Cross this week?
Well, we heard quite a bit this week from President Ray Cross. Earlier this week, only about a year into his current job, mind you, he told a group of UW Milwaukee students and employees that he would resign if the proposed cut to the UW isn't reduced.
Strong words there. And was the cut the only thing that he was concerned about?
Yeah, very, very strong words. He also is very concerned with protecting tenure and shared governance. Cross said that any university leader would not want to be part of an institution that isn't committed to those two things. He says he is also very interested in protecting shared governance and tenure.
Now, Cross has been having a tough time with these negotiations. Seems like taking criticism from a lot of sides, more or less. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'd say nearly every
direction. Nearly all sides.
Nearly all sides, other than maybe from his own office. No, he is being criticized on several different fronts. A lot of staff and faculty are upset with his plan to turn the system over to a public authority. You know, they argue this kind of transition, just it hasn't been studied enough. They also say this whole process lacked the transparency that it demands. Lawmakers, another group, a key group of stakeholders, have also criticized the plan. They say it's not ready for prime time. And there is also some unease with what would happen to tuition if the system had more power over tuition, which would happen potentially under a public authority.
And specifically, what has Cross said about the cuts and the plan?
Well, Cross has said he will fight to shrink this cut, and he continues to fight it. He argues the public authority is a good thing because it protects things like tenure and shared governance and provides what he calls really a stable and predictable stream of state support, as opposed to things changing every few years based on the budget. You know, with this plan, he says it would be a bit more predictable from a revenue standpoint from the state.
So now, under this plan, how would a public authority protect tenure and shared governance?
Right. So under this plan, the system would actually be basically turned over to the Board of Regents. And they just recently passed a resolution saying they would protect those two things, both shared governance and tenure. So under a public authority, at least in theory, those things would be protected.
And obviously that tenure a bone of contention right now.
Right now, and absolutely. And, you know, it's a question moving forward. If the public authority doesn't happen, if the legislature retains control, there is a question mark as to what may happen with tenure or shared governance looking towards the future.
And some more news now from the UW system. UW-Superior has joined UW-Eau Claire in offering buyouts.
Right. So this is significant because it's the second campus to make the offer publicly. Eau Claire said it was offering buyouts recently. You know, it's all of this is notable because it really appears this cost-saving technique or strategy is being adopted by more and more campuses. Now, it's been done before, but it's not routine. And every campus is facing some pretty deep cuts, and each one has to decide, you know, how is it going to balance the books? And it looks like these, you know, buyouts are going to be a viable option for campuses should they want to do it.
And why do these proposed cuts seem to be hitting UW-Superior hard in particular?
Well, it's a campus that has faced a lot of financial issues in recent years. In addition to the cuts at the state level and the ongoing tuition freeze, which is putting a lot of pressure on that campus, it is also seeing a drop in enrollment. So it's really a perfect storm for UW-Superior. It's facing a multi-million-dollar shortfall, and that's due in part, at least, to payments it has to make on debt service for some building projects. projects that it's undertaken in recent years. And I have to say, you know, this isn't the first cuts that the university has made. It's a school that has already been cutting. Superior cut 53 faculty and staff positions to help balance its budget. So again, it's a university just trying to balance its books, given the cuts, the current cuts and the cuts that may be coming down the pipeline.
We're talking about state news right now with our news guy, Noah Ofshinsky, WBR's assistant news director. And Noah, any indication as to how many faculty might be taking up UW-Superior on the offer of these buyouts?
Right. So it's, you know, it's a small campus by UW standards. And UW-Superior has 78 employees who qualify for this buyout offer. It's unclear of how many of those 78 will actually be offered the opportunity. The school is going to decide, you know, on a case-by-case basis. You know, of course, it depends on the educational needs of the institution. So I think what these professors and faculty, what they teach, will also come into play here.
Now, we were talking about UW-Eau Claire earlier. This is the first of the UW system schools to offer a buyout. What do its finances look like?
Right. So under the governor's plan, this $300 million cut, the campus will see about a 23% decrease in state support. And campus officials say around 25% of their faculty and staff actually qualify for the buyouts. That's around 325 people. So that's quite a few people who may be given this option in the coming months.
And now finally, we're going to finish off with a decision on the job of Christopher Manny. That's the officer involved in the shooting death of Dontre Hamilton last April. What's new there?
Right. So former Officer Manny was never criminally charged last year after the shooting, but Chief Ed Flynn did fire him for violating department policy. The hearing this week was to determine whether his firing was appropriate, and this was held by the Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission.
And this was a high-profile case, drew a lot of attention, not just in Wisconsin, but nationally. Can you frame that for us as to why the attention?
Right. So the killing of Dontre Hamilton, you know, it drew protests, and, you know, it came at a time when the killing of men of color by police was really getting fresh scrutiny and capturing a lot of headlines. And, of course, even up to this day, with, you know, revelations we've heard in Ferguson, with racism within that police department and the protests that happened after the killing in Ferguson, and of course the killing of Tony Robinson right here in Wisconsin. So this issue of police involved shootings and men of color, it's something that, you know, continues, you know, to this day.
And do we know what the commission was looking at as they considered the circumstances of the firing of Christopher Manny and Dontre Hamilton shooting?
Right. So they had to decide a few things. First, you know, did he violate policy by patting down Dontre Hamilton? The commission said yes. And second, was his use of lethal force in this case a violation of policy? Again, the commission voted yes.
And then the commission had to figure out whether his firing was appropriate, right?
That's right. And that was really the third question they looked at. And again, the commissioners said yes, it was appropriate for him to be fired. In fact, during arguments, Mark Thompson, that's Ed Flynn's attorney, the police chief in Wisconsin, you know, one of the things that people talked about during the hearing was, you know, the messages that the various outcomes would send to the community and the police. Here's Mark Thompson, Ed Flynn's attorney, talking about the fact that if they did choose to uphold the firing, that it would send the right message.
Those officers that follow that training, they're doing the right thing. And secondly, it sends the right message to the community that this department will not tolerate bad pat-downs and profiling.
Now, Manny's attorney said the exact opposite. John Cermelli said firing Manny actually would send the wrong message, especially to police officers.
What's the message they're going to send? Don't go in there. Back off. Wait. Call for backup, even though you know you can handle this situation, because you don't want to get Manny'd. All right?
And so ultimately, the commission upheld the firing of Officer Manny. Is that the end of the story?
Well, the commission's ruling is final, although this may not be the end of this case. Dontre Hamilton's family has indicated that they may still file a civil lawsuit in the future. So stay tuned.
Well, Noah, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ofshinsky covering the biggest headlines from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
In a preliminary vote yesterday, the Wisconsin Public Service Commission voted unanimously to allow the construction of a new power line running from La Crosse to Madison.
The decision has been years in the making, with those opposed to the project citing environmental and aesthetic concerns. Those who support it have pointed to economic growth and a need for more energy transmission.
Here with us now to talk about this decision is WPR reporter Maureen McCollum, based in La Crosse. Maureen, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So, is this a done deal now before we get into the history of this? Is this the last hurdle for this transmission line?
Technically, no. The commissioners still have to make everything official. It has to be signed into a written order, and that'll happen at the end of April. Also, we're hearing, we'll get into some of the details in a couple minutes, but some of the opponents to the project are weighing their options whether or not they want to challenge the decision, and they could do that by either requesting the Public Service Commission to rehear from them, or they could take this to a circuit court and have a judge sort of review the whole decision.
Well, let's look at the road to yesterday's decision.
Yes.
How long has this been in the making?
This has been going on for years. Officially, about 3 or 4 years, but we've had different energy companies and transmission companies talking about the need to upgrade our energy grid, our energy system, for decades, probably. So the one thing I think that a lot of people can agree on is that power lines, the poles themselves, you know, the technology that goes into our energy grid has becoming a little outdated, and something needs to be done to improve that system. So what the Badger Cooley line is doing is it's taking, you know, what you see is, not to get too technical, but essentially 161 kilovolt lines, and it's going to upgrade it to 345 kilovolt lines. So this will allow a, you know, more voltage to essentially travel through the system. The energy companies like Xcel Energy and an American Transmission Company, they're partners on this project. They say it's going to improve reliability. It'll allow them to bring in wind energy from the west and, you know, essentially increase capacity.
And why this connection, La Crosse to Madison?
It's really part of a bigger regional picture. Okay, so there is this essentially a regional energy planning organization called MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. And MISO has played a big role in helping shape what's going on within the Midwest when it comes to energy transmission. MISO had identified the Badger Cooley line as a needed project to increase the system and improve the system. I don't know how many people remember the debate surrounding the CapEx 2020 line. That's a project that was approved by the PSC about a year or two ago. And that is essentially the same project, but it's these major transmission lines moving in from the Dakotas, and it crosses the Mississippi River, travels down into Wisconsin a bit, and ends at a substation in Holman. The Badger Cooley line will connect with the CapEx line in Holman and travel off to Madison.
So why does it take so long to get a line like this approved?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, there are a lot of issues that play into this. I mean, you're looking at engineering. There are a number of like environmental hurdles that need to be crossed. There are just issues when it comes to safety. When it comes to routing, like choosing where each individual pole is going to go, you know, there are a lot of decisions that have to be made. It's not like this was made willy-nilly. I mean, these are years and years of research that goes into deciding what this project will do and where the project will go.
We're talking with WPR reporter Maureen McCollum about the proposed and now tentatively approved transmission line between La Crosse and Madison. Got a nod from the PSC, the Public Service Commission, yesterday, talking about the road here and what happens next. Well, Maureen, let's talk about the opposition to this line.
Yes.
Is it generic against the whole line, or is it we don't like this piece of the route, or some combination of both?
Oh, it's definitely both. And I would say that each opponent has their own reasoning for opposing the line. So you have the big question is those who question the actual need of the project. Why do we need to upgrade the system? Why do we need to install these massive poles? A lot of the opposition has questioned whether or not population growth actually shows that the energy needs are there. Some would argue, and there are contradicting studies about this, The opposition would say population is not growing at a rate that causes a need for this. You know, especially when it comes to conserving energy. You know, you look at your washer, dryer, and your refrigerator is most made now to are not consuming as much energy as they had in the past. You know, on the energy side, from the different companies involved, they say, no, our projections show that we will have more need for energy. The opponents, you know, some will say, we need to look at local energy production. You know, let's put up more solar panels. Let's, you know, let's look at wind turbines, which is a whole other issue in Wisconsin, and produce the energy here. We don't need to be bringing it in from out west. You know, there are questions about the safety of having a massive regional energy grid. But then you have some, you know, some of the issues when it comes to aesthetics. You know, the CapEx line and part of the Badger Coulee line is running in an area that will be, you know, along the Mississippi River Reserve. And, you know, it's going through some beautiful areas. It's and you're going to have these poles that are basically a couple stories high. They're not going to be those wooden poles anymore. They're big metal poles. So from an aesthetic standpoint, people are concerned about how this will affect their property values. It's going through some very rural areas. It could cross through farmland. Some farmers are concerned about stray voltage and the effect, especially that that can have on dairy cattle. Each of these poles has to have quite a bit of right-of-way, so you could be losing land that was formerly in production. And there's also some concerns around the Baraboo area because this line will be traveling down 9094 from about Black River Falls to Madison. And, you know, there's some very natural areas with protected birds around Baraboo. So just concerns about how the birds will avoid the lines and if the lines will have any impact on them.
One thing that utility consumers might worry about with something like this is often when there's a big new utility project, some kind of cost of paying for it are borne by the consumer. Is that part of the proposal here?
Yeah, the project itself is estimated to cost up to $580 million. Of course, that could change. And Wisconsin consumers will be paying 15% of that. Now, the one thing that I think people are still waiting on answers for is, remember how I said this is part of a bigger regional plan, that MISO plan? Wisconsin consumers will be paying into those projects, too. We don't really know how much that's going to be yet at this point. So at its minimum, that's what we know so far is the 15% for Badger Coulee. But what else? What else is further down the line?
Now, one interesting point, this is not taking necessarily the shortest route between two points. I gather it's going to skirt around a large Amish community in the state. How is that decision made?
The decision for routing is really quite interesting. I have no idea how the commissioners have decided to how they've decided to pick the route that they did. You know, essentially they're looking for what route will have the least amount of impact. So I'll kind of walk you through what the route will be. So it's going to be traveling north from Holman, which is just north of here, La Crosse, up to Blair, Wisconsin. So about northeast Trempealeau County, head east over to Black River Falls. And that whole area there, that's a pretty rural area. There are going to be farms that are impacted there. But once it hits the highway, once it starts traveling down 9094, you know, it's going along the interstate. People will be impacted, but, you know, I think a lot of people did agree that at least traveling along the interstate, maybe not as many will be impacted.
And you mentioned earlier there is still some opposition being looked at, asking for a redo here or
sure.
Some legal challenges. So what are you watching for there?
So the opponents, they haven't decided yet, but the two ways that they could challenge this is by petitioning the PSC to rehear their case. They felt like they weren't heard as much as they should have been. They had asked the PSC to really look at conduct a more thorough needs analysis for this project and explore other options. The PSC said they explored all their options, but the opponents wanted more. Senator Jennifer Schilling of La Crosse has criticized this move. Representative Steve Doyle of Onalaska has criticized this move, the fact that the PSC didn't open up the greater needs analysis. So that's something that could play into their challenge. Otherwise, they could the opponents could ask for a judicial review in a circuit court. So I think they'll probably be deciding whether in the next couple of days they should do that or not.
Now, if that doesn't happen and things keep moving forward, is there a timeline for when construction would actually start on this line?
Yeah, I think American Transmission Company is hoping to begin construction sometime next year, and they want to have it in service in 2018. And it's interesting because for anyone who travels around western Wisconsin, you may notice that CapEx line that I had mentioned before, that other major project that's going to be meeting up with Badger Coulee line, that construction has recently begun within Wisconsin. So as you're traveling along, I think it's 53 there, you know, headed through Galesville and whatnot, you'll notice the posts and the different work going into getting those lines in place.
Maureen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
We've been speaking with WPR reporter Maureen McCollum, based in La Crosse, about the decision yesterday by the Wisconsin Public Service Commission to allow the construction of a new power line connecting La Crosse and Madison.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Remember this song, Waterfalls by the band TLC? It was a mega hit in 1995, a soundtrack for a landmark year. Our next guest says 1995 was a pivotal time in recent American history, a year that continues to shape life as we know it today.
Joining us now is W. Joseph Campbell, professor in the School of Communication at American University. His new book is 1995, The Year the Future Began. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Rob and Veronica, thank you very much for having me on your show. It's a pleasure.
Now, we're going to get into some of the big items from 1995 we're still feeling today, but big picture, what drew you to this particular year out of all the years available to us?
Well, it was a year that was in the back of my mind for a long time in terms of doing a book project, and I remember quite vividly the end of 1995 when Newsweek magazine had a year-end cover story, in which it declared 1995 had been the year of the internet. And I thought Newsweek laid out a fairly persuasive argument that why and how 1995 had been a year of the internet. And it was really the first time that I had gone online, too, in 1995. So it was in the back of my mind, Rob, for a good long while. And when I finished up a book that came out in 2010 about media-driven myths, I turned my attention to 1995, and we aimed, the publisher, University of California Press, and I aimed for a publication date in early 2015 at the 20th anniversary of 1995. Et voila.
And you call the year 1995 a hinge moment in history because of all the significant events that occurred that year, and as you list them, they begin to pile up, you start to go, wow, there really was an incredible amount of big, big news that influenced a lot of the future to come. What were some of those key moments in 1995?
You're right, Veronica. It was a very important year in many respects. It was the year of the emergence of the internet and the World Wide Web into public consciousness, into the mainstream, if you will. The web and the internet had been developed years before, but it was in 1995 when it really hit a critical mass. 1995 was also the year of the Oklahoma City bombing, the single deadliest attack of domestic terrorism on U.S. soil. It killed 168 people, and it really signaled a deepening national awareness and preoccupation with terrorism. It was the year, of course, of the double murder trial of O.J. Simpson in Los Angeles, a trial that spread across the year from January until the verdicts were announced. His acquittal was announced in early October of 1995. It was also the year of a U.S. brokered peace agreement that ended the very bloody and very vicious war in Bosnia, the worst war in Europe since the time of the Nazis. And it was the year in which an intern named Monica Lewinsky met Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, and began a dalliance ultimately culminated in the president's impeachment and trial before the Senate. So, yes, indeed, it was a very full year. It was a full year in many respects, in new media, in domestic terrorism, in crime and justice, in international diplomacy and political scandal.
Well, let's take some of those in turn. The internet. Why a pivotal year, 1995, in the emergence of the internet in the public consciousness?
It was really, as I say, the year in which the web, the emergent World Wide Web and the internet made the move into the public domain, if you will. It reached something of a critical mass. The internet had long been the domain of academics and techies. But in 1995, it began to, in a very important way, make the move into the mainstream consciousness. And people, not everybody, not all Americans were online in 1995, far from it. But everybody had heard about the internet. Everybody had heard about the web by the end of the year. And everybody was intrigued by what this new phenomenon was. And more than that, entities that we recognize as important to the online world today trace their origins to 1995. Amazon.com started selling books in 1995. The predecessor to eBay went online in September of 1995. The predecessor of Craigslist.org got going in 1995. So did Match.com. The Wiki was developed. The first Wiki was launched in 1995. Yahoo was incorporated that year. The founders of Google met for the first time on the campus of Stanford University. At first, they didn't like each other, but their collaboration turned into what we know as Google to this day.
Talking to Joe Campbell. Talking to Joe Campbell about his book about 1995 as a pivotal year with the internet. Joe, looking at it from 1995, did we know what we were getting into then?
Oh, I don't think so. I had no. I think people had no idea what this would become. In fact, there was a fair amount of skepticism that the internet, the World Wide Web, would become something like the Citizens Band Radio in the 1990s, a fad that would be passing and wouldn't catch on. And there are people who had been online for a number of years who bought into that fairly pessimistic assessment. But it really, the web, the architecture of the web was good enough in 1995 for this to become a very fertile time. Digitally fertile time. And what really illuminated the web for many, many people was the IPO, the initial public offering of stock of Netscape Communications. And Netscape was an impressive, very popular web browser. And its IPO in August of 1995 just electrified Wall Street and illuminated the web as nothing else had done beforehand. And everybody said, whoa, what is this? And it was really that moment catalyzed, in many respects, interest in the web, as well as the dot-com boom that took place in the second half of the 1990s.
And it really tells you something, doesn't it, that the internet is probably one of the few examples you can point to where we didn't overhype something. It actually was that big a deal.
You know, there were some tech gurus back in 1995 who said the danger is in underhyping the web and the internet. There were people who were saying we need to have more hype associated with it because it's going to be big. And they were right. I'm thinking here of like Nicholas Negroponte, then the director of the Media Lab at MIT. He was saying the danger is in underhyping and underestimating what this could become.
And moving on to another one of these pivotal events, 1995, as you mentioned, saw the Oklahoma City bombing, the deadliest domestic terror attack in the U.S. Obviously a devastating event, a huge casualty list, but how did it shape what was to come in terms of our perceptions and our fears about terrorism, domestic and otherwise?
It really shocked America, and it was an unprecedented attack deep in the American heartland. And it led to a deepening preoccupation among Americans and American officials with taking steps, taking efforts, taking measures to thwart the prospect of terrorism. And that impulse, that tendency to try to prevent or block or thwart even the risk of terrorism took hold after the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 and intensified in the years afterwards, certainly with the terrorist attacks of 9/11. So it was, in some respects, it was a demarcation moment for the United States. And soon after the Oklahoma City bombing, about 6 weeks later, a two-block section in front of Pennsylvania Avenue nearest the White House was abruptly, summarily closed to vehicular traffic. And that was one of the many steps that was taken in the aftermath of the bombing to regulate and to control the prospect of a terrorist attack.
Now, next month, I think, is the 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. You mentioned 9/11, though. Outside of Oklahoma City itself, has that bombing been overshadowed in our minds? Are we paying it the attention it deserves today?
That's a very interesting question, Rob. I think 9/11 certainly did overshadow in terms of just the magnitude of the attack and the casualties. And Oklahoma City was a shock. It reverberated throughout the country, and in the immediate aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing, the news media really jumped on the notion that this had to have been an attack by Middle East terrorists. And that notion, that argument was widely circulating in the first day and a half after the bombing, until Timothy McVeigh was arrested and linked to the bombing, and then the shock was redoubled, because the thinking was, well, geez, it's an American who did this. And McVeigh, of course, was a disgruntled Army veteran who was angry at the U.S. government for lots of reasons. And he timed the attack on Oklahoma City, April 19th, 1995, to coincide with the second anniversary of the attack at Waco in Texas. And that was a an attack that ended a very long standoff at the Branch Davidian compound in Waco. And that was one of McVeigh's many grievances about the U.S. government.
What about the media coverage of that? Was that also a watershed event that you can package in with that event itself? Because we had that 24/7 coverage of it, which maybe Americans hadn't seen that magnitude of press coverage before.
You know, Veronica, it in some respects signaled the emergence of the Internet, of the World Wide Web, as a source for news. I think USA Today, for example, its online site had been up and running for 2 days before the Oklahoma City bombing, and they suddenly had to deal with this major news event, one of the year's biggest news events, and to do so without having really a whole lot of experience with going online with news. And the Daily Oklahoman, the newspaper in Oklahoma City, sort of backed into having a web presence. Someone who had familiarity with the web volunteered to put some of their content, both articles and photographs, online. And they hadn't really anticipated going online at that time, but they did. So they sort of backed into an internet presence. And it's hard to identify the demarcation moment when the web became an important news source, but that was one of them. The Oklahoma City bombing aftermath certainly was one of them.
We're talking about 1995 as a watershed year for the present and the future, a year, I guess, has shaped life in America today. And you can join our conversation. What do you remember about 1995? How did events like these, the Oklahoma City bombing, rise of the Internet, the O.J. Simpson trial, affect you? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our discussion with Joe Campbell, but first a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the influence the year 1995 had on the decades that followed right up to today, and we want to hear from you. What are your memories of 1995? Did you watch things like the O.J. Simpson trial, the Oklahoma City bombing, the war in Bosnia, and did you watch them online? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
W. Joseph Campbell stays with us. He's professor in the School of Communication at American University and the author of the book 1995, The Year the Future Began. And Joe, you've called the year 1995 a bridge between the 20th and the 21st century. Can you tell us more about what you mean by that?
Absolutely, Veronica. It was one of those rare years that project an enduring and continuing influence. As I mentioned earlier, the year was when the Internet and the World Wide Web entered the mainstream. They became household words. This preoccupation with terrorism and measures to thwart the prospect of terrorism also took hold, and they have intensified in the years since 1995. We haven't talked much about the O.J. Simpson trial, but one of the lasting consequences of the O.J. trial was to introduce, again, to mainstream consciousness, the importance of forensic DNA evidence in determining guilt or innocence. And the O.J. trial was the first major murder trial in the United States in which DNA evidence played an important role. In the end, the O.J.'s defense was clearly able to establish that the collection and processing and evaluation of the DNA evidence was tainted and corrupted by the L.A. Authorities. But nonetheless, the trial introduced the notion, the promise, and the prospect of DNA evidence into the mainstream consciousness. And the U.S. foreign policy after the Dayton Peace Accords, which the United States brokered to end the war in Bosnia, gave a certain sense of muscularity to U.S. foreign policy, a muscularity, a hubris even, that continued for many years afterwards until the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And of course, the dalliance between President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, a nominal White House intern 27 years younger than he, that was an affair that would shake the U.S. government, imperil Clinton's presidency, and lead to the spectacle of impeachment and trial of a sitting U.S. president. It was the first time that an elected U.S. president had been impeached. So yes, these events all reverberate to this day. They were, in very important respects, evidence that the future began in 1995, the future as we know it.
And in some ways, a lot of these stories haven't even ended yet. There may be a Clinton running for president again this year. War crimes trials still going on for massacres in that Bosnian war you mentioned. These aren't even just shaping our present. They're still part of our present in a lot of ways.
You're right about that. And you know, Monica Lewinsky has returned to the public stage, if you will. She wrote an article for Vanity Fair last year, about a year ago, and an article that was a finalist for a national magazine award. I mean, she didn't win it, but it's evidence that the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton scandal, or reminders of that, those reminders are not going to go away. And she gave a TED Talk recently in I think it was out west somewhere, but she's back on the stage in a very prominent way. So you're very right, Rob, that this is not going to the effects of 1995. They continue to reverberate, and they will continue to do so for the years ahead.
And I'm wondering if you think we'll ever see a year like that again. Seems like a lot of convergence going on there, a perfect storm, and it, barring the invention of some world-changing new technology, it changes pretty quickly now. But do you think that 1995 was just a special year?
I really do. It was a special year. It was a special year of transformation and convergence of trends that were very important and continue to influence us to this day. But your question, Veronica, is quite interesting. It's one that has been discussed in since the book has come out. Some people wonder if 2008 might be recognized as a watershed year down the road. That was, of course, the year in which Barack Obama was elected to the presidency. Some people suggest 2001 has to be recognized as a watershed year, and it's certainly a strong candidate. I do think that a passage of time, a sense of critical distance, is necessary for determining whether the year is really has been a watershed. And I think a minimum of 20 years is necessary for that. For that to take hold. I mean, some years you know right away are going to be decisive, like 1968 and probably 2001. But other years, it takes the passage of time for those influences to reveal themselves.
It's probably a lesson there about how we think of the present day and how it's going to look from the future. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Rob and Veronica, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on your show. It's been great.
That was W. Joseph Campbell. He's a professor in the School of Communication at American University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called 1995, The Year the Future Began.